ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, beloved listeners. Giuseppe joins me in welcoming you to another Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land, long before the movie American Fiction made it to Netflix. Writers and publishers have been grappling with the idea of the race novel. Now, if you missed it, it's the story of a frustrated African-American author who writes, a satirical novel, using all the stereotypes expected of black authors, only to find it's being taken for serious literature. And just as the black American character in the film confronted race and class expectations, First Nations writer in Australia find themselves at the mercy of similar prejudices. Now, joining me now is Tony Birch. Tony is the author, he's a very busy fella, the author of four novels, two books of poetry, and five short story collections. He's the Boisvivier Chair in Australian Literature at Melbourne Uni, and his most recent work is Women and Children. Before we go any further, tell me about the named chair, please, Tony.
Well, the chair is a philanthropic chair, so it's named in honour of Miriam Boisvivier, who is the French consul in Melbourne. She's the partner of John Wiley, and as a couple, they wanted to donate or grant a chair to the University of Melbourne, which focused on Australian literature, and of course part of that is for me to look at First Nations literature. So I'm the third recipient of the chair following Richard Flanagan and Alexis Wright. And I do a lot of work in the university in regard to guest lectures, but I have strong external projects as well with local high schools, with festivals, and teaching into a narrative medicine program in the medical school at Melbourne University. So it's a busy role.
Tony, Women and Children tells the story of a young boy named Joe, and he's growing up in a working-class suburb in the mid-1960s. And one of the things that intrigues me is how gently you mention the matter of his ancestry. You hint, but you don't tell the reader of his background. Why this strategy?
Well, I wanted to, in a sense, provide an insight into identity that was true to the period rather than how we might prefer to think of identity today, which is in some ways more essentialist and more defined. So if you're growing up in the inner city of Melbourne in the 1960s, there would be many kids who would be, particularly where I grew up in Fitzroy, known as Aboriginal kids. But there were also many kids whose background or identity, although identified formally as something we might call mixed race or coloured, the uncertainty around their background was around family secrecy, perhaps. It was perhaps around a story of the family that was lost, so that there were many kids who could be Aboriginal, Australian or white. They could be Maltese. They could be from another so-called minority or coloured community, but they would not have a essential story to tell. So I wanted to write a novel where this boy knows that his grandmother is a woman of colour, but what his family story is beyond that is unknown. So that mystery that remains in the novel was something I thought was really true to the period and certainly true to part of my own experience as a child.
Tony, no artist enjoys being, well, typecast, but to be typecast by race is perhaps particularly unsettling. Is the pressure that adheres to some restrictive notion of what it means to be Aboriginal a common experience for First Nation writers?
It's always a tension, Philip, and I think for any younger or emerging writer, it's more than attention. It can become quite difficult to deal with. I'm fortunate, one, that I'm much older. I'm 67, and I didn't publish my first book till I was 49, so I was ancient by then. I think I'm much more equipped to deal with those pressures. It's quite complex, so that if we were to take the notion of the tag of being an Aboriginal writer, it's a very positive experience when you're thinking about mob that you hang around with. In other words, the Aboriginal writing community in Australia is very tight-knit, very supportive, so that when we meet up at festivals, we like to catch up with each other, we go to each other's sessions. So in that sense, being part of that community is just a wonderful experience for me. But in regard to the writing itself, or how the writing is received, or even perhaps how you should behave at a festival, that can be problematic. And I think it'd be easy to explain this in relationship to last year when we had the referendum for the constitutional recognition to Parliament. I didn't want to partake in that discussion when I was doing write at festivals. I wanted to talk about fiction. But I would gently point this out to festival directors, and very politely. And, people that run festivals, I think, enjoy my attendance. I show up, I do what I'm asked to do. But even when I said I didn't want to engage with discussions about the referendum or treaty, et cetera, I was sometimes put on panels without any consultation dealing with those very issues. So I find that always an issue to have to deal with and wrestle with, so that I think that there are issues that I don't have the expertise in, I don't have the particular interest in, and therefore I want to focus on what I do know and what I can talk about well, rather than thinking that every Aboriginal writer has to talk about what a wider audience wants, or that we're experts in matters that we're of course not experts in at all.
You're hearing the voice of Tony Burch. Now, how does this kind of racial stereotyping play out in an Australian context? What sort of books or works would First Nation writers and artists be feeling the pressure to produce?
Well, obviously, what you might call an essential Aboriginal story, but often a story that suits a white readership, so that you could even say that some people want a relaxed and comfortable story from Aboriginal people, to quote John Howard.
Please don't quote John Howard.
the more abrasive and confronting the issue is, I think the more uncomfortable some readers feel. Having said that, I have to say that, we have had writers who have become very successful in national literature. So Alexis Wright, Melissa Lukashenko, Kim Scott, Tara June Winch, all winners of the Miles Franklin Award, and all writing novels that are asking really big questions about colonialism, about issues of gender, about, certainly in Alexis's case, issues of country and the environment. So we are being... there is a receptive audience for that type of writing. But I think a more telling personal example would be in my own work, and you just talked about women and children. I have been asked, well, is this an Aboriginal novel or not? Are these children Aboriginal or not? And I think that some readers, possibly publicists and publishers, and certainly not my publisher, would prefer a story like that to clearly identify the so-called race of the children, so that then it can be marketed more clearly as what you might call an Aboriginal work. Secondly, Philip, you talked about me having 5 short story collections. If anyone's to pick up any of my books, there are sometimes stories in it that the characters in the stories are clearly identified as Aboriginal for necessity of that particular story. And then there are stories where the race or ethnicity of the characters is not discussed at all. And people will again ask, well, is that a white character or not? And there's a wonderful quote or comment from the writer Percival Everett, who wrote the novel Erasure that became the movie American Fiction, where he states that if you write a novel and in the first 10 pages, if the ethnicity of the character has not been defined, then the assumption is that the character can only be white. So therefore, as writers from, First Nations, African American, other diverse cultures, if we don't identify our characters as having a particular ethnicity, there's an assumption that the characters are white. In my place with the short stories I write where I don't identify the ethnicity of the characters, if someone says, well, was that character white or black? I can say with great honesty, I say, oh, well, I don't know. I'm more concerned with the fact that that character is a woman who's dealing with domestic violence.
Well, your writing is often more concerned with class than race.
Oh, absolutely. And that is not a contradiction. So that particularly for Aboriginal people living in the inner cities, and if we were to take the experience of Redfern in Sydney, certainly in Fitzroy in Melbourne, I think class is the most clear defining characteristic of any kids and growing up there from the post-war period, certainly into the 1980s. So that, again, in my own experience, on the street or in the playground, you know, there were Aboriginal kids, poorer white kids, Greek, Italian, you know, kids from all over war-torn Europe coming to places like Fitzroy in the 50s and 60s. What defined us collectively was that we were all working class. Our parents worked in factories. We didn't have a lot of money. And that generation of kids that grew up in that period, even though we have so-called ethnic differences, which I find problematic anyway, thinking about it in that way, we have wonderful connections, which are the connections of being working class. And you're right, working class writing is probably the clearest way to define my work.
It seems, Tony Burch, that a real, and it must be said, long overdue flourishing of First Nation literature has occurred in Australia over the past decade or so. Is that how you assess the situation?
Yeah, look, it's complex, but it is true. So that the writers I just mentioned who'd been awarded the Miles Franklin, and obviously it's not just about prizes, but the fact is in the last decade and a little more than that, we have had writers on the national stage being awarded major literary awards across the country. Another one would be the Stella Prize, which certainly Alexis Wright and Evelyn Araluen have won, another great young writer. So yes, there's been a real flourishing of literature at a national level. That literature is increasingly being taught at secondary and tertiary level. So students are getting much greater access to First Nations writers. So that is wonderful. And I think that will grow because we do also have a wonderful new generation of writers like Evelyn Araluen, another poet, Jazz Money, a writer I love, a young writer, Graham Ackhurst. These writers are going to be producing a lot of work, you know, into the future. I think, though, Philip, we still have issues to deal with, and they're at the basic level of access to literacy.
Well, that's something I was going to raise, because at the grassroots level, we're still dealing with a series of profound challenges, getting Aboriginal kids to read more and even to go to school.
Yeah, so look, I have a relationship with Preston High School in Melbourne's northern suburbs, has a fairly strong Koori Aboriginal contingent in that school. And one of the programs I run out there is to engage young people to do their own work, to do creative writing, but that also involves them appreciating and growing a passion for reading. So it's certainly a challenge. I think that if we look at the failures of the Closing the Gap policy of the federal government, in particularly regional parts of Australia and so-called remote parts of Australia, we still have enormous challenges of making sure that young Aboriginal kids are fit, healthy, cared for, and able to get access to good education, to good health regimes. That's not happening enough, and we all know that. We still have terrible, terrible incarceration rates of young people, and I think these issues are linked. I think we need to be sure that we're caring for our young people, and I firmly believe that reading, education, people valuing their own story is central to that. Philip, Alexis Wright has a wonderful essay where she talks about the value of storytelling, and I profoundly believe that we need to tell younger First Nations kids that literally say to them, your story matters, you're entitled to have your story heard, you're entitled to share your story. And part of doing that, of course, is reading and listening to and hearing and reading the stories of other First Nations people.
Despite the appalling outcome of the referendum, more and more Australians are listening, are wanting to hear those stories as well. Now, I know you've already pointed out you have a, shall we say, a problematic relationship with writers' festivals, but I remember going to them, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, and you might see none or one First Nations writer.
Yeah, and I should point out, when I say I've had a problematic relationship, it's just in relationship to what I want to do. I would have to say that when I get to festivals, I enjoy them. The people who run them, they look after you. I love the audiences. So my experience once I'm at a festival is much more positive. I just want to make sure I say that. I think that your point is so valid, because if I went to a writers' festival 15 years ago and I was on a panel, I'd be the only Aboriginal writer. And if I wanted to talk about something like land rights or care for kids or self-determination, it wasn't uncommon to have several hostile people in the audience who would ask very hostile questions. What happens when you go to a festival now? There usually would be 8, 10, a dozen Aboriginal writers,
as I said, and a large crowd to hear them.
Massive crowds. There is a really strong interest, and I think the crowds, if not better educated, certainly want to be better educated. So I do engage with audiences that I really appreciate, and so do the other writers that I know. And if there are occasionally hostile people in the audience, there's always about 10 of us anyway. So
you got them outnumbered.
Yeah, they tend to quieten down.
I find it hard to think these characters still exist.
Oh, they do.
Is the progress the result of improvements in the publishing industry as a systematic whole, or is it just sort of occurring in small pockets, Tony?
Well, I think look, to the credit of the publishing industry, I think there are a number of publishers who are remarkable supporters of our writers. And
University of Queensland Press would be one of them.
Oh, yeah. So my publisher, UQP, has a long history of supporting First Nations writers. Hachette, I know a few people at Hachette, and I've chaired a few sessions when they've had First Nations writers put their books out. I think they have a really strong commitment. Simon & Schuster, I know a couple of the publicists there. So, yes, I think that some publishers go out of the way to make sure that things are changing. I think the two points would be, it's not a form of affirmative action. The work is of great quality, and that's important to note that. Secondly, I think where we're still lagging behind, or what we need to do, is I want to see more First Nations people, particularly younger people, right across the industry. So
they're working as editors or publicists?
Exactly. And I've been working with, in my example, I think a really strong example here, Philip, is that about 4 books back, I was introduced to a designer, a book designer and artist, Jenna Lee, a Larrakia woman from Darwin. She designed the cover of one of my books, and it was just a wonderful working relationship. I loved her work, her wonderful eye for art. And what we've done since then, we've gone over the back list, and Jenna has designed covers for a couple of my back copy books. She's certainly done the covers of my more recent books. So for Women and Children, a poetry book, Whisper Songs, my last story collection, Dark as Last Night. And I love the pleasure of working with a young Aboriginal designer, not only because I want to work with an Aboriginal person, but I love to see her out there in the book world now designing for people right across the spectrum. So in other words, not to be put into what could be seen as a ghetto of Aboriginal writers and designers working together. I love the notion that those designers are working with non-Aboriginal writers as well.
Before we push on, I think you should talk briefly about Magabala Books, which is fully staffed by Aboriginal people.
Oh, Magabala has been a remarkable success. They're publishing books right across the spectrum in different genres, certainly in fiction, poetry, non-fiction. Got a great range now of children's books. I mean, they really, Rachel Binsala, who has done all the really heavy lifting at Magabala, runs out of Broome, probably run on the smell of an oily rag for many, many years. And then a book came along called Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe, and that has allowed them to not only increase their staff, they've probably got better air conditioning now and they're doing a lot more books. And the success of Bruce's book has been remarkable, not only for them in a cultural sense, but in reality, the commercial success of Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu really changed the game for Magabala being able to support a much larger number of young writers, and he should be thanked for that.
I'm a great supporter of Pascoe. When he was in all that sort of trouble, I thought he'd made so many useful contributions to the great debate. Now, to ensure future progress is made, where should the industry focus its energies, Tony Burch?
Well, I think there are things that happen that we could increase. So one of the programs that I really have supported is the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne runs a project called Next Chapter. I think I would say they've run that for about 4 years now. What that project does, and this is just as one example, it financially supports new and emerging writers over a period of a year. And then they're also given a mentor who works with that person across the year. And in my case, the example is pretty straightforward. I was the mentor for Evelyn Araluen. So the book that we worked on, or that I helped to work on, became the poetry collection Drop Bear, which won the Stella Prize and many, many other awards. Now, I take absolutely no credit for that. Evelyn's a wonderful, wonderful poet. I'm very OCD, Philip, and I'm an old Christian Brothers boy, so I know about order and time. So I just kept Evelyn on her toes. But that program, while not directed towards First Nation writers, has always included First Nation writers in the successful group. So I think one thing we need is to have programs where young First Nations writers are given not only financial support, but given the mentorship by senior First Nations writers to guide them through the process. And I think it'd be good to see that repeated across again, all aspects of the publishing industry.
Well, one thing that occurs to me are book reviewers. It would be wonderful if Aboriginal reviewers were reviewing not only Aboriginal books, but books.
Well, I do that. I've just reviewed Bruce Pascoe's new book, and the only problem I found with the book is he unfortunately mentions Richmond Football Club too many times, which I picked him up on. I think that we do need Aboriginal reviewers, again, reviewing Aboriginal writers, but of course right across the industry. That is, again, starting to happen a bit more, Philip. So about 4 weeks ago, we had the Black and Bright Writers Festival in Melbourne, and there was a major session on what's called Black Criticism, and that session dealt with the very fact that you're interested in, and that is Black critics writing on Black writers and how that will change the industry. So that's happening. But of course, as I've already said to you, that we need to see more of this. Last year I focused all my reviewing on reviewing books by emerging Aboriginal and other First Nations writers as a means of making sure I could get some traction for those writers in the press. I've just finished a book on Kim Scott, the great Noongar writer, for the Writers on Writers series that comes out through Black Ink. And last year I also wrote a major essay on Alexis Wright last year. So in my own case, the role that we talked about when we opened today, the Bois Vivier role, allows me to spend a lot of time focusing on Aboriginal writers and engaging with them intellectually. But yes, we need to see more of that.
Now, you're getting on a bit, as you pointed out, but I'm certainly much older than you are, and so I was on the original Whitlam era Australia Council, where the head of the Aboriginal Arts Board was the wonderful Wanjuk Marika. And I'm wondering whether you're getting, you've mentioned the Wheeler Centre, but I'm wondering whether you're getting mentorships and grants out of the Australia Council or whatever it's called these days.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Australia Council the problem with the Australia Council is not within the council itself. As you know, the arts sector in Australia, it sometimes gets torn apart depending on which party is in government, and it's certainly not a party that would that Gough Whitlam would recognise. I think that the politics around the arts community is problematic in the sense it can really affect the level of support that those bodies should get. The Australia Council does have very specific sectors that deal primarily and only with First Nations writers, so that happens. Again, if we look at the number of writers who are coming through and the support that can be given, it's really not enough to support the writers that we want to support. So at the bottom line, there's always an issue of money. But having said that, I think money's not everything. It is about, I think if there was one thing that you want to show a young Aboriginal writer, it's this, Philip, that when I was starting to write, the number of Aboriginal writers that I'd read, I could count on one hand. It was very difficult to get hold of material by Aboriginal writers. Now, for a young, say, young Aboriginal woman who wants to be a writer, she needs to be introduced to someone like Evelyn Araluen, someone like Melissa Lukashenko, to say, all right, here's an Aboriginal woman who's not that much different than me. In Melissa's case, had a really hard struggle to get to be a major writer. And by engaging with those older, established Aboriginal writers, I think those younger writers get an incredible sense of sustenance and courage to do what they want to do.
Tony, we've both used the word problematic, and I'm going to use it again as we wind up our conversation. The problematic issue regarding white and non-Aboriginal writers. Have we reached consensus on what a writer should and should not write?
No, and I don't think we ever will. And I don't think that's a problem, by the way, that we don't reach consensus, because it is a contentious issue, and it is an issue that interweaves politics, art, culture, self-determination. So it's not necessary to resolve it. That might seem odd. If I ever was to make a comment on this, it would be to say, I'm not making a comment on this. Alexis Wright wrote a seminal essay in 2016 called What Happens When You Tell Someone Else's Story. She published that essay in Mianjin Literary Magazine. That essay is available to anyone who wants to Google those details. I would read Alexis's essay, because it's not an essay about censorship. It's not an essay about who can and who can't write. It's an essay about ethics and responsibility. And it's a wonderful essay that ask all writers to critically engage with the process of whose story you tell. And I would suggest it's not a question that can be answered simply. It's a discussion that takes detailed and ethical conversation.
Good on you, Tony. That was a terrific contribution to the Little Wireless program. Tony Birch, author now of Women and Children, amongst numerous other books. And you can see Tony at the upcoming Melbourne and Sydney Writers' Festivals in May. Now, coming up, a chat with another writer coming to the Melbourne Writers' Festival, Andrew O'Hagan. Heard rumours that I'm heading for the door in a couple of months, and we've been digging through some of my favourite interviews for a new collection heading your way in June. We thought we'd give you a preview of one we've chosen. Back in 2012, we were in Edinburgh for the Writers' Festival, and I sat down for a chat with Scottish author Andrew O'Hagan and his good friend Carl Miller. Sadly, Carl died back in 2014. Andrew, on the other hand, is doing well, and he'll be heading to Melbourne for their Writers' Festival in May. And he's always worth a listen. Enjoy. Three of Britain's most talented writers, poets and essayists are great mates and have made three road trips together, driving around the countryside of Scotland, Ireland and Wales, not only as a way of spending time together in enjoyable company, but also as a literary homage to some of their heroes. Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet and winner of the 95 Nobel Prize for Literature, joined his friend and editor, the founder of the London Review of Books, one of the sponsors of this great event, and author Carl Miller, together with their driver, the Scottish novelist Andrew O'Hagan. Now, this impressive trio have visited the graveyards, the memorials, and the birthplaces of the likes of James Hogg, the Arnold of Yeats, Jonathan Swift, and inevitably Robert Burns' birthplace. But what I'd like to discuss with Carl Miller and Andrew O'Hagan now is something which interests these two writers in particular, and which haunts in faraway Australia the imaginations of our writers and poets, that is the importance of landscape and what connects literature to the land. Andrew O'Hagan is one of Scotland's most successful novelists and essayists. His latest book has a title which has won my award for the most preposterous title of the year, The Life and Opinions of Maff the Dog and of his friend Marilyn Munro.
Well done.
I'd like you to note that this title is in marked contrast to that of his very first book, which was simply The Missing, an acclaimed portrait of mid-1990s Britain, and about his time spent as a reporter outside the home of Fred and Rosemary West as the bodies of their victims were discovered. It was being turned into a very successful play. Carl Miller is the former editor of The New Statesman. I've got every issue that he edited, and The Spectator, and the founding editor of the London Review of Books back in 1979. He's written numerous books, including biographies of Lord Henry Cockburn, and one of his heroes, the aforementioned James Hogg. And his latest is a collection of essays called, and I trust I get this right, Tree Tower to Clyro. Mm-hmm. The former, of course, the site of a fabulous castle in Wales, the latter a small village. Gentlemen, welcome to this windswept tent. Carl, in reviewing your latest effort, Margaret Drabble notes that you're very fond of salting your prose with Scottish vernacular. Words like nay and bro and old and gomeral, and I think I should point out to Australians that latter term is a silly fellow. So even though you've spent most of your life living and working in London, you're really still a country Scottish lad.
Well, yes, I am. And it's quick of you to smoke me out. It's about the use of Scottish terms, as Margaret Drabble calls them. That came quite naturally to me because I grew up in Edinburgh, just outside, speaking in a Scots voice, almost as Scots as O'Hagan here managed to speak for a longer time than me. I spent most of my life in other countries, mainly England, and I lost some of my Scots, but I never really lost it, and it's almost quite natural to me, and to Andy, I think, as well, to use a Scottish word. And in most cases, they're within the capture of English readers and Australian readers too, I would suggest.
Oh no, we find them quite easy to comprehend.
Yes, that's right.
But Drabble's a bit ungenerous because she goes on to suggest that you have a weakness for people called McThis and McThat.
Yes.
And mountains called Ben This and Ben That.
Yes.
I greatly admire
well,
Ben That.
That's just examples of my stylistic brilliance cropping up. I don't mind a certain amount of repetition of that sort. Well, yeah, her review was very generous, as a matter of fact. I had no trouble with it. But we're not, either Andy, who has his tendencies, nor I, are florid stylists.
Well, Andrew here actually made up a word to deploy in his foreword to your book. He says that you talk about writers who give the land a voice and use the word finesseful to describe them. Some things need new words, don't they?
What does it mean, Andrew?
Well, something full of finesse, I hope. Finesseful. I'm rather in with Carl when it comes to this business of Scots making up words. A great poet in Carl's youth and in my life too is Hugh McDiarmid, who didn't only produce Scottish poems which sounded very Scottish, but there was something called synthetic Scots. There was a certain amount of making up, wasn't there, Carl?
Yeah.
Taking joy in ripping words out of science textbooks, looking back into the old 17th century Scots habits of speech and making up new forms from there. Yeah. And I think that's always been, as it is in Australia indeed, part of a very rich, cheeky effort on the part of the literary culture to just rip words from wherever they can be found. And often the sound of words, as much as their meaning, is what people are after. They care about the sound of words up here.
I have to ask, what sort of vehicle do the three of you drive around in? I want to have an appropriate image. Is it a Range Rover or something more humble?
I wished to God I could say that it was, you know, a sort of powder blue open top 1969 Thunderbird. But in fact, it was my rather sad-faced little VW Polo, which is the most common car, and silver, which is the most common colour of car in the UK at the moment. So we get no points for originality. Well, we'd like to think of the wind going through our hair in this convertible, but that wasn't to be.
Andrew, when you were visiting the islands off Ireland's west coast, after travelling by pony and trap up a hill, you wrote these words: at the top of such a place, you can imagine for seconds at a time that urban life is only a dream. Standing up here with the castle solid and the wind whistling and the light moving over the ancient stones below, you could think of Theocritus on the Isle of Kos, or Virgil in Arcadia, or of fairy tales.
I think one of the things that Carl's essays have brought to mind, or a truth that they've brought home for me personally, is the idea that perhaps we're always in mourning for a sort of Arcadia. Those of us who have been urban dwellers, I live in London, have done for 20 years. But even those who live in less populated cities and places have a sort of almost unconscious attraction to the country place, to the country idyll, to the quietness and the eternal peace of somewhere remote. It's a strong thing in all of our cultures, in Scottish certainly.
And of course we bottle up tiny hints of it in our city parks, don't we? You
know, we do.
The city is full of tiny parks which evoke at least a scintilla of the same feeling.
In Glasgow, where I was born, you know, the parks are formidable and beautiful and endless. And yet they're in the middle of what was described as the second city of the empire, full of slums at one time, full of shipyards, full of an urban experience. But these parks gave people that exact feeling that there was an Arcadia on their doorstep, that there was an almost peaceful idyll that they could step into at a moment's notice. And I think we all need that. It's something essential to us.
Of course, there's some lying in that, isn't there? In that there never was an Arcadia of that sort anywhere, even in Arcadia.
I think in a way that's why I refer to it, and you do too in your book, as a dream. Yeah. That it's a pastoral dream that we have. I'm not quite sure why we need to have it, but it's traditional in this culture to dream of those empty lands.
Yes, that's true. I admired Raymond Williams's rather taxing book on the country and the city, because he said that the country wasn't exempt from commerce and so on. People were raising cattle and doing all these things to make a living, and that is a reality there, just as it was in towns. The thing, just to add a further point, the thing that intrigues me is what people have who have no actual physical conditioning in relation to rural life, in place of our experience, which I share with Andy, of having rural pictures, country pictures, constantly in my mind. After all, I didn't spend my time in a green spot.
Do you see them through the eyes of painters?
Yes, yeah, sometimes. Oh, yes, yeah, sometimes. And I see them in dreams a lot. And I also confuse what I read in books with what I've actually experienced. Do you have that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that fascinates me about Scottish culture is that in movies set in Scotland until very recently, and including the new cartoon from Pixar, it's a very strong notion of Scotland as a rural place, that it's about the Highlands. And just as in Australia, for a long time, movies and pictures would be about the outback. Yeah. We have a strong myth of the outback here too, that there's a kind of almost more truthful selfhood out there, but away from urban conditioning.
But in our case, of course, only a tiny percentage of people live in the rural.
Well, that's
in
true
the
here
vast
too.
Rural yeah. sector, about 6%.
Oh, yeah, same here. And there are great expanses, Philip. There's people sometimes, three or four to a glen still in 2012.
This is as a consequence of the Highland clearances.
It was clearances, yeah.
But now it's very markedly different. If you go up a glen, which you've read about in the 19th and 18th centuries as being populous with people walking about, talking to each other, now you're hard put to it to run into people. You see that in places like Rajasthan in India, where the countryside is full of social life and people living in cottages, much like the ones in Scotland used to be. But now things have changed. I just wonder where somebody not acquainted, even through books or movies, with the country, what pictures they have of the country. Do you think they don't have any pictures of the country?
There's a brilliant moment in Trainspotting, which of course brought urban Scotland into focus for a lot of the world, where they take the train to the end of the line and they're in the country. Do you remember, Carl? Yeah. It's a brilliant scene because these urban boys, with their liking for half bottles of vodka and recreational drugs, are suddenly in something called the Scottish countryside, yeah. and they can't believe it. It makes them nervous. They want to get back to
agoraphobic,
Edinburgh. They're almost agoraphobic, yeah. indeed. They hate the wide openness of it, and they think, what's this got to do with us? They actually say, it's shite being Scottish. It's a very good speech, actually, in that film. It's very funny.
Yeah, it's a very good book in that way, showing these contrasts. But of course, one of the features of the Scots of the town-country distinction is that the two things aren't starkly different all the time. I mean, many people, James Heaney's poems, for example, very often you take a particular poem, you can't say this is a country poem or this is a city poem.
What an interesting point.
And they were written, in the one end of Ireland and in the other end of Ireland. And the experiences you record, so they're set in the country, are completely intelligible to town people, aren't they?
Andrew, as one wanders around Edinburgh, you are constantly reminded of how this place is punched above its weight. One thinks of modern economic theory, for instance, coming out of the town, and certainly the influence of medicine.
Yes. I mean, you have to say, and this is what I get on my boasting horse, and say that Edinburgh, not just Edinburgh, but Glasgow, has been punching above its weight in literary terms, but also in terms of, as you say, economic theory, also in terms of medicine, but also in terms of philosophy. The great David Hume comes from this city and is well remembered here. And you might almost say that he invented a certain kind of human inquiry into the business of humanness. And that changed the world, and as did the literary magazines that grew up here. I mean, it's wonderful to have Carl here because he, in founding the London Review, continued a tradition that goes right back to the 18th century of the Edinburgh Review, Blackwood's magazine. Those great magazines, we're not talking about limited interest magazines here. We're talking about the kind of magazines that carried Walter Scott and Charles Lamb and Hazlitt and a great deal of Scottish greats. So it was a period of genius, and we, as you can hear, take some pride
in its continuation. And rightly so, but you talk about Scotland now as a living workshop of the imagination.
Well, you know, I grew up slightly proud. I'm not given to pride or nation tub-thumping, really. I'm not a nationalist in that sense at all. But I do take some pleasure, as I did as a boy, in the fact that Scotland, for all its being something of a backwater to some people, was in fact, as far as the human imagination goes, a great engine room. And it still is. And it's mattered to me in that way.
Carl, I'm sure you remember the term cultural cringe coming out of Australia, yes, where we all tugged the forelock to Britain and were endlessly apologetic about what we saw as our lack of, yes, achievement. That there was something of a cultural cringe in Scotland, yes, until quite recently.
I think that's true. In Scotland, there was an ambivalence about it all. So on the one hand, you had to be very impressed by the royal family and by what was happening in Eton and Cambridge and so on. On the other hand, we were better than everybody in the south and so forth. So you had this yawing between the two attitudes, which I find rather distressing. I never liked Scottish boasting for that reason, but then English boasting is hardly any better. In the case of Australia, the difficulties swing over from deference, the old deference, to the English-speaking culture in its London metropolis form, to independence. And that independence is often just as ugly as the sort of thing you got in Scotland eventually, where they felt better than everybody else. I can't see why they always have to be better than somebody else. Just do what you want to do. It's difficult to say that you would want them to go back to cringing, but you don't want to go back to superiority either.
Well, Paul Keating, one of our more amusing prime ministers, said we went from the cultural cringe to the cultural trot. And we did. You know, there was suddenly a moment during the Whitlam years in particular when we decided that we were cutting edge and we were, you know, yes, demonstrating to the world our, yes, vibrant, yes, creative democracy.
Yes. It's a struggle. In Scotland, when I grew up, there was a strong sense of it being rural and remote even, so that we had to make an effort to be noticed. Not that I was making many efforts at the age of 14 in Gilmerton. I was just doing the things I was interested in, but I was aware of a more ample and opportunity-fruitful background in the south, and it was easier to get a job in the south. On the other hand, that has changed a good deal. Scotland is less exclusively rural in its image than it was. Is that not right? Even though urban Scotland in the 18th century was the centre of the world in terms of intellectual terms.
I mean, I think there's a lesson here, and it was one that Carl, in an earlier book, in Doubles, which captured that sense in Scotland of being one thing and its opposite at the same time. It's no accident that we're sitting in the city that produced Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as well as The Confessions of a Justified Sinner by another of Carl's subjects, James Hogg. These are writers who took an interest in the idea of duality. And Keating's comment puts me in mind of that same energy, where you can be both cringing and trotting at the same time. And I think that here in Edinburgh, here in Scotland, there's a virtue put on that you can be both proud of the nation, but also rather sort of wishing that pride wasn't the only question in town.
Let's feed that into the notion of the current political debate, or the growing political debate on independence. That's half cringe and half trot, perhaps?
Maybe so. I mean, it's great to see Scotland gain in economic confidence and in self-worth. But if that means disliking your neighbours that you've been in fruitful collaboration with for several hundred years all of a sudden, then that seems to me a backward step. I think Carl and I agree on this, that it's possible to live in a forward-thinking and changing, evolving nation that has more sense of itself as a devolved power, without it becoming about small wars and the Balticization, if you like, yeah, of Britain, which would be a shame. It's already a small group of islands, and I think it should just stay as it is.
Carl, you've long opposed intolerance, and you're no friend of nationalism, but where do you stand on this issue?
Well, I'm in agreement with what Andy has just said. I've been somewhat appeased by the developments under Salmond of Scottish nationalism. I can see that devolution has a point to it, and they've done rather well in certain respects, I think. Nonetheless, I don't see that the case is made in favour of a separation which involves Scotland competing with England. and also saying that the joint life of the United Kingdom was all a mistake and has to be jettisoned entirely. It would be a mistake to do that. And also, one of the worst things for both Australia and Britain is the deference that's now paid to America.
That's a much greater problem, in my view, yes, than vestigial links to the United Kingdom.
I think
the
so.
Great Republic of America,
that's
is a bigger
right.
problem for a Republican like me.
I quite
Absolutely.
Agree, yes.
You know, that's a whole other subject, Philip. I think we need to come back when we get our books
but
of
But it's a subject
America.
That you've written about, very interestingly.
It is, actually. It's been at the forefront of my mind, as an essayist, certainly, since I first took up the pen, and I guess it's not going to go away. The sense of ourselves having to constantly respond to America's sense of itself. We're going to have another year of it now with the forthcoming election in America. We're already those who think that having a passport and being an American is actually quite a nice notion. In other words, the Republican view that the inwardness of America is what matters. We're again having to face that down. And the rest of the world is always now responding to America's arrogance, I think.
But you've had a long period, as we did, of political acquiescence to America.
Oh, yes.
And I'm thinking particularly of our response to the Iraq War, where we both countries signed up as members of the Coalition of the Willing.
It was a sad moment, really, for those of us who grew up through our teens in the age of Margaret Thatcher and thought that the notion that the UK had become the 51st state of America, we thought that might be over when Labour was elected and we had Tony Blair. But of course, Tony Blair, perhaps to an even greater degree, yeah, allowed himself to become a puppy.
Did that anger you, Carl? Did
Oh, yes, it certainly does. And Thatcher started it, and it was already there anyway. But it's got worse. And we really stand in great danger of acquiescing in American mistakes, which are colossally important at the moment. And unless you get a really balanced and decent critique of America going in Australia and in this country, we'll be in trouble.
This is a good time for me to raise the kilt, and I mean metaphorically rather than physically, because, Carl, I understand it dates back to a time between the Jacobite rebellions and is said to have been invented by an English Quaker. Could this be true?
Well, I got that from Trevor Roper's investigation of the kilt. Yeah, I think it's true, yes. It wasn't an ancient garment. But the kilt was a garment that was used not only in Scotland by any means, but it got going as a prescriptive flourish of national identity and so on.
I had hoped you'd be wearing one today.
No, well, I haven't worn one for 50 years.
Carl, did you publish that Trevor Roper essay about the invention of tradition, which pointed out the kilt wasn't quite Scottish?
I've taken an interest in it and written about it, but I didn't publish that.
Well, I think we've got to lower the kilt and, in fact, wind up the chat. Thank you both immensely. Andrew O'Hagan, his most recent novel is called, and I take a very deep breath, The Life and Opinions of Maff the Dog and of His Friend Marilyn Monroe, and Carl Miller, author, essayist, whose latest book is a collection of essays called Tree Tower to Clyro, published by Quercus. Gentlemen, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that was a chat recorded in Edinburgh back in 2012. And that's your lot. Thanks for a great week to E.P. Anna Whitfield, producers Catherine Zengra, Taryn Priadko, Ian Coombe, Chloe Adams, and Amanda Roberts. See you next week.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.